I'm Stuart Sheldon.
My name's Ron Rothberg.
30 years ago, I was on Wall Street. I was the youngest vice president at my fancy company, but that's not what I wanted to do.
After spending nearly 25 years in media, I knew things were changing, both in the industry and inside me.
Swan Dive shares the powerful stories of those who had the clarity and backbone to make a major life pivot to their vision.
I took a swan dive.
I have been an artist ever since, and it's the best choice I ever made.
Getting closer to who you really are. That's Swan Dive. Clark Butcher has been redefining the cycling business by pouring his fitness, energy, and passion into his Memphis-based bike shop, Victory Cycles. So far, it's been a rewarding ride.
My team and I have made this city healthier. We've shown this city the beauty involved. I mean, dude, this weekend I got videographers from Outside Magazine coming in this weekend to do a piece here, and I'm going to show them all around the city. For me, cycling has become more therapy. It started out as a hobby, then it went to a sport, then it went to a career. Now it's a therapy. And look, I need an hour to hour and a half a day just so I don't choke somebody.
Saddle up, lock in, and take a spin with an all-new episode of Swan Dive. From the Peacock and Park Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, and in Costa Rica at the Fancy Nasty Studios, welcome to another edition of Swan Dive with Ron Rothberg, that's me, and Stu Sheldon, that's you. Howdy, Stu, what's up?
Hey, puta vida, Ronnie. Ready to rock and roll, man. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I gotta say, this is in my wheelhouse today. You know, when I did my Swan Dive, I ended up like backwards in a bike shop. You know, my Art Bikes Jack's business landed me in a bike shop. And I will tell anyone who listens that I never knew how cool it was to hang out at a bike shop until I started hanging out at a bike shop. It is just the absolute greatest place in the universe because people come to a bike shop for all the right reasons. And for that, it is a magnificent intersection of life.
We have a lot to talk about when it comes to bikes. As obviously, I spent 7 years at a bike racing magazine, and we're going to get into that too. But it's fun. Today's fun, and I'm going to get right to it. Our guest is Clark Butcher. They say that the first step to addressing addiction is admitting you have a problem, and Clark Butcher will be the first to tell you he is addicted to endurance athletics. He started running at age 7, completed his first half marathon at 11, and discovered triathlons at 14, where he naturally excelled in cycling. By 16, Clark was a formidable full-time bike racer, competing in the Junior Worlds in Canada, the National Championships, and pro-caliber events throughout the country. This all culminated in 2002, when Clark spent a summer racing throughout Europe with the German national team. Our guest is the founder of Victory Bicycle Studio in Memphis. I was a very, very delighted to spend some time there recently, and it is one of the tightest bike shops you'll ever see. And it has grown from a small part-time project to a national industry retail leader. It is much more than a bike shop, and we're going to learn why today with our wonderful guest. Clark, welcome to Swan Dive.
Yo, thanks. Thanks for the hell of an intro.
How'd you like that? Did it feel good for you?
God. I mean, That was solid. Here's the coolest thing is you didn't even read that. That was Lil Wayne.
I just knew that, bro. You didn't even tell me that. I just knew it. What I really want to do today is I want to sit back and listen and watch while two bike shop geeks geek out. And it's really fun because while I have not spent as much time in bike shops, I do understand what Ron was talking about. And there is a magic in there. And Clark, the first question to you is that magic of a bike shop. How old were you and when did you discover that that was a whole world unto itself?
Hey, I love this is the starting question. Look, I grew up going to the bike shops early on. I grew up in an endurance household. My dad was a runner. Cycling was really just kind of a hobby for him or just kind of on the side. So they're really introduced at a very recreational level, you know, in terms of introduction to the sport. But look, it's one that I still tell the story of the first bike shop experience, which was, and look, I'll give a shout out because I'm still great friends with them, even though they haven't been in the bike business in probably 30 years. But Richard and Marcia Andrews, this family, they owned their own shop called Bike Line. It was in Germantown, a little suburb here in Memphis. tiny little shop, maybe 1,500 square feet, 1,200 square feet total. But I remember my experience there, and I remember that's where I used my bar mitzvah money to buy my first like real road bike, like first good real road bike. But it's funny, like just like that, like here we are. That was when I was bar mitzvah, right? So I was 12 years old, and here I am. I still remember their first and last name and the couple. I remember their daughter's name. And it's one of those we're still friends on social media. So it's super funny. I remember that experience because I think the bike shop experience should be something memorable. And it's actually the reason why, if we ever want to dive into it, why I exclusively did not carry kids' bikes for probably the first 7-8 years of business. And now I carry kids' bikes. And for that exact reason, like, man, I want to be that experience for them. I want them to talk about me in 30 years.
I was just going to go there because what you were describing was what I see often, you know, the grandma coming in, holding hands with the little 5-year-old and, you know, jumping on a bike and pedaling for the first time, and grandma having that responsibility, you know, having that moment with that kid is indelible. It's indelible. Here you are all these years later telling the first and last names. I see it. I see it every time. And that's why I said, I had no idea I was going to be in a bike shop, but that was the thing. That's the magic in there. This kid is going to have its first freedom.
You know, and it's something, you know, my favorite is always looking at the parents, like when we get the nervous child out front to ride the bike. And number one, they're always nervous, right? Because we're in an urban environment right here. We're not like Parkside. B, you know, it's typically the child's outgrown their previous. So whatever we're putting them on is a little bit larger. So you've got some hesitancies there, but it's always fun to look at the parents and be like, hey, if you don't mind, I'm happy to drive, you know, or else there's the emotions like, come on, Tucker, get on the bike already, you know, where it's like, while patience is definitely not a strong suit of mine. It's one of those, like, I always make it clear and I always look the parents in the eye. I'm like, hey, you got to know, like, I have an interest in selling them bikes for the rest of their bicycle purchasing, right? Which is middle school, high school, hopefully one before they go to college. So like, I'm not going to screw up this experience. So, mm-hmm. So just so you know, I have the agenda that this, you know, little Tucker remembers this.
Right. Ironically, the name of the bike shop that we exist in, Tucker Cycles.
Shut up.
I just swear.
Went with Tucker because it's like a Southern. It's
just got you guys Southern get a room, man. Get a room.
Truth.
So I mean, there's the competitive side of cycling, and then there's little Tucker, and I was little Tucker, and I don't know about you, Clark, or Ronnie, I suspect you as well, but my entire childhood was coming home from school, throwing my book bag on the table, getting on my little banana seat, you know, bike, and cruising around with my friends, and we'd make jumps and we'd explore the neighborhood, and it was how we got around. It was the crux of our exploration, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. My kids don't have that so much. We live in a more mountainous area. They just don't have that same level. But Clark, was that you? Were you just, you know, that little kid just going down to your friend's house and then you pick him up on his bike and then you go down to wherever, and you know, or was it always a more sort of going to a race kind of vibe?
Yeah, it was. I mean, look, like anyone else, you know, growing up, I grew up in an awesome apartment complex. And I say that as like the density of friends when you grow up in apartments versus a home is awesome. Like we had, you know, the second the bus let out, like, it was, are we playing manhunt? Are we playing tag football? Are we riding bikes? What are we? So it was just a very, you know, it was just active. This was also like, obviously like pre-social media, really, I mean, pre a lot of the internet for that matter. So it's, yeah, we're outside. You know, it wasn't until it went to sport. And when it became sport, then it was funny. It was like, I was missing out. Like I'll never forget in high school, for instance, the second the bus let out, you know, until I was driving, but the second the bus let out, where I grew up was about a 10 to 11 minute ride from my house to single track trails at Shelby Farms, kind of a centrally located park here in Memphis. And it was one that it was funny. It was literally, so school got out at 2:15. I was really off the bus about 2:45. If I did it right and could throw my chamois and jersey on, you know, at a rapid rate, I could be easily at the trail by 3:15, which meant more laps, more time. But it was funny. Like I missed out on a lot of the traditional high school stuff, which was like chasing girls, the high school fights. Like, really, I went to public schools. I missed out on all like the cool fights that went down after school because I was racing to get home on my bike. So it was just, it was totally different. But yeah, I mean, for me, it wasn't so much freedom. It was, look, I was an ADHD kid, and there's nothing better than just some repetition, and I'm on my own. Team sports were never a total match. I suck at basketball because I can, I suck at soccer. Everything's on my right side, so you always know I'm going left. You know, so I was like the easiest kid to guard. So yeah, it was just team sports were never for me, and cycling is just one that took. But it was funny. It wasn't really till later in cycling that I was competitive.
Right.
Early on, it was running, and it was fun, and it was just exciting, and there was no pressure of any sort. But it wasn't till later on that I realized, like, man, I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah. Well, let's get right into that, because for those folks who don't know about cycling, the U.S. Cycling Federation has a ranking system to put you where you're competing at sort of the appropriate level. And the highest level is category one. You were category two at 16, which is extremely impressive. And the guys at Cat Twos they're crushing it. So you were an elite athlete at a, pretty young age in a very, very vertical pursuit. I mean, cycling is a niche. Tell us about what it was like being a Cat Two at 16.
Yeah, 100%. Look, it was one I flew through the ranks to Cat Two pretty quick. And that was, a handful of races at the age of 15 and then just flying. It is important to note that I was a Cat Two from 16 to probably 21. So it's fun. It was every time you cat it up, and that's what I called, kind of the upgrade or going to that next level. And it goes from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1. And it was every time you cat it up, the first couple, like, I found easy. I found, like, until all of a sudden, you get to like the Cat 3 level and you realize, okay, now these guys are more or less my pace. And then each kind of climb after that took a little longer because the air got a little thinner and obviously the competition got steeper. It's a beautiful way of filtering out riders that are also at your level. The other was my biggest thing was it filtered out riders that are making the same sacrifices as you, which kind of touches on that, which is, man, it's saddle time. Like, right now we train folks on specificity over just, more is better. We don't have football players run 4 miles at spring training anymore because the average plays 9 seconds. Why are they running 4 miles? So it's one of those, like, yes, things have gotten more specific, but still, to be competitive in those ranks, you are putting in 600, 700, 800 hours a year. And you start looking at that and it's the time investment, but it was like, yeah, I mean, Cat 2 at 16 was really awesome. And so what you've got to know is in the U.S., you race Pro 1-2, which means from the time you're 2 on, the only way to really achieve points is you're beating ones and occasional pros. So it took a while before I finally went Cat 1. And it really took strategy, finding the right races where I knew I could really take advantage of my strong suits.
So you used the word sacrifice. What did you sacrifice?
Time, man. Think about it. It's, even now I don't, while I still compete, I always say I won't pin a number on, just cause, but it's one, like, it's sacrifices. It's going in early. It's not having that extra cocktail out with your friends. It's not, going to that wedding party afterwards with your spouse. It's, really, cause you can't, cause then you're going to wake up feeling like death. Your legs feel like shit. Now you put out bad numbers. Now you recover bad and everything's off. So yeah, it was sacrifices both at night as well as, let me tell you what, like, a lot of these races, especially growing up in the South, they're not in like desirable areas. We're not on the West Coast. Like, I'm not racing up and down Laguna, man. I'm racing in shithole Mississippi, and it was funny making these crazy sacrifices all week to go and race in Brookhaven, Mississippi. That's Like, that's not glamorous, you know. So, but you had to do that stuff, yeah. And so yeah. I mean, those were the sacrifices, and it wasn't glamorous then when you got there.
Yeah.
There's another part of that answer too of sacrifice in my very limited opinion, or experience, I should say, and that is pain.
Oh,
the physical
sure.
pain of and challenge of pushing your body to the limits. And I mean, I never pushed my body to the limits that you have, Clark, but that is something that it you need an extra gear in your body, in your mind, in your spirit to push through to those levels that you obviously have. And I want you to talk to us a little bit about how you faced pain, how you ate pain, and how you used pain to win.
Dude, awesome question. Mm. Yeah, it's one that, yes, it's, you know, it, real quick, you know, we always said in physiology, if you want to go to the Olympics, pick your parents well. So at the end of the day, I'm about to give you tips that work for me. But at the end of the day, if you want to go to that 1%, like, pick your parents well. It doesn't matter how fancy a bike you purchase from me or how great a training you receive. Like, it is genetics at a certain degree. But to get through the ranks, it's funny. My first coach as a junior, first formal coach, he saw in me I could follow the training plan, right? The first step was following the plan. If you followed the plan, you knew you would arrive with the best amount of fitness. And he always made it clear to me. He goes, man, you're the fittest guy here. So as soon as you start to hurt, attack. Because you got to know if you're hurting, everyone's hurting worse.
Wow.
And so I had that mentality. And here, real quick, anyone that's listening right now, if you want to sail through the ranks, this will get you very fast to the Cat 3 level. Get super fit. And when you start to hurt, you attack. Mm. And I did that. And, you know, it was won many, many races, literally with that attitude, until all of a sudden I realized, oh, shit, man, there's a lot of guys that are all hurting about the same right now. Mm.
You know that that reminds me, Andre Agassi wrote an autobiography and he talked about that very thing, about getting to the hurt. And when he got to the hurt, that's when things started to get real. And that's when he relished his training, was to get to the hurt, just exactly as you put it.
Yeah. Wow. There's something about it, right? Like, there's something beautiful about going and riding a bike and just enjoying the cadence and the breathing and getting comfortable and getting in your rhythm. There's something beautiful about that. And that's what's probably most addictive. I do enjoy the pain. I do enjoy putting myself at a level of output and a level of stress and holding it as long as I can. And, you know, and every time I break it down, I'm like, well, science says I should be able to hold this. And that was my mentality into pushing through. And even now today, you know, I have spin classes here at the shop and I love teaching spin. And one of my favorite things to yell out is, as these riders are in the middle of an interval and I know they're hurting, is I always say, no one's died yet, you know, and that is like, push yourself. Like, there's something really cool about reaping the rewards. And it was always put to me, the harder you dig and the more you follow the plan, the greater rewards you'll reap. And the greater rewards meaning the greater fitness. And in cycling, that means greater fitness means I can now hurt at a higher level, which means I'm just going to continually raise. And I use car analogies, right? And I use it as a red line. So every time you do a hard interval workout and it's hurting and you've still got to hold that output for another 2 minutes, you're raising that red line. And my goal is to get to that race day or get to that performance day. And my red line is, man, just a little higher than yours. Mm. And that's where all of a sudden, so now my fatigue onset starts at a little higher than yours. And I recover at a little higher rate than yours. And all those little things add up. And then you've got a great athlete. But it's, yeah, man, there's something addictive about being so strong, you can control any field. You can be wherever you want in the race. You can animate it. You can be the one that everyone's watching. You know, like, there's something always fun about knowing you're the strongest dude at the race and everyone's waiting for you to do something.
Right, right. A couple of the other beautiful elements in cycling that I observed were, there's a level of camaraderie that's profound. There's a brotherhood out there. There's a sisterhood. There is shared pain, shared gain, shared strategy. And there's this magnificent opportunity to really be in the world. My wife and I, for her 50th birthday, went and rode a backroads trip in Tuscany. And people asked me how that was. And I said, you know what? I got to smell Italy.
Mm.
I got to smell the country.
Nice.
And the countryside and see, you know, you see the cracks in the walls of the old buildings. You don't just see the building driving by. So talk to me a little bit about both of these experiences for you, about the camaraderie that you share. I imagine you have lifelong friends that you've been riding with and new friends being made all the time, as well as the way it took you around the world and the way you see a place and know a place on your bike.
Yeah. Hey, awesome. We can tackle that in a couple different phases. Like, one is, you know, first and foremost, it's funny when you're racing, you don't really get to look around and
correct.
And you're glued to that wheel or you're hyper-focused on counting down the kilometers till that climb's approaching or that right-hand turn when the crosswind's going to hit. So racing was one, like, I didn't really never got to see anything. And it was funny, like, having a, you know, your Jewish mom growing up would go, hey, how was Milwaukee? And I'm like, fuck, I don't know. Like, there were six of us in a hotel room and we raced and we ate at Fazoli's and we slept because we're racing again. You know, like, we didn't go to a museum. Like, I didn't bring it's funny, like, I've been a lot of places and haven't seen much.
That's going to be the name of this podcast, by the way.
Yeah, I've been a lot of places, ain't seen much. But like now I travel everywhere and I take my bike everywhere with me. And so now it's so funny. My wife does not ride, but it's great in that she loves that I ride and I get that energy out. But I'll come back and I'm like, hey, we got to go to this vineyard that I found. We ain't never been down this road. And right. You see it differently. And like, it's funny. I know so many roads around Memphis and I can tell us where we're at in the dark. I don't know the name of the road. I don't know which direction we're headed, but I know exactly where we're at and exactly how to get back. And so it's, you just see things differently by bike, you know? So, the camaraderie side is it's a culture. You know, and you've got to know it's the same thing in my store. I always say, like, I really don't care if you buy a bike from me or not. Like, I need the bike is permission to market, and I need you to buy into our culture because I'm addicted to it. And yeah, I've got lifelong friends. It's one of those that I've made so many sacrifices for the sport and put in so much time. The original start to my business was really, man, I want to get some payback on my investment. And realizing that a sustainable, real paying pro career was not in my cards. And yeah, it wasn't till looking back that, like, man, my first mentors ever were all met on the bike. Hmm. You know, I hung out with an older crowd from a very, very early age on. And, you know, still to this day, it's awesome meeting Stu. And I'm also jealous meeting Stu in that, you know, I met you and your lifelong childhood friends. And I'm like, I was telling Micah that day, he was asking who I still keep in touch with from growing up. And I was like, man, everyone's from cycling. I've got two friends from, you know, Hebrew school growing up that from preschool on that were still buds and still talk all the time and still go out to eat. But mostly, like, really, man, in high school, I was hanging out with guys twice my age, historically, upper level, I guess you'd say executive level individuals. So I was surrounded by guys that were smart, shrewd. They taught me how to talk. They taught me how to act. They taught me how to carry myself. They taught me how to present my fake ID and act like I didn't give a damn. They taught me how to talk, you know, sell and get what I wanted. They taught me work ethic. You know, it was one of those. So it's funny, like, the camaraderie was really a culture growing up, and it still is today. And I love looking around at our group rides, and I love watching on social media that, hey, these two people that met in our group ride, look, they're all spouses and they're all going on a vacation together. And they met at our group ride a year ago. Like, that's so damn cool.
So, you know, I want to go back to the culture of the bike shop because, you know, you're referring, you know, cycling is a sport. But it's also recreation. It's also exercise. It's also a place to meet your form, your future spouse. So I see it in the bike shop here. You got the god of you that knows cycling inside and out, and somebody like the little kid, little Tucker, is intimidated. How do you talk to all these different people and make them welcome into this force of energy? What is it? How does that? Because you can't be the sports guy for the person who wants to just get on the bike to get a little bit of exercise. How does that culture manifest itself inside the bike shop?
You know, again, a great mentor growing up always told me, he said, you can adapt to a personality or you can steer clear of a personality. Those who adapt tend to be successful. And it's one that I love speaking to all individuals. And I love the way that, you know, the way that we, like, for instance, I'm going to kind of answer your question in a roundabout way. And that's, I love to tout that at my store, over 60% of our sales are females. And that's unheard of in the bike business. And, you know, we have a part-time female now, but it's funny to get that. I tried hiring the super fit triathlon woman, right? Well, that intimidated a lot of folks, and especially females. And okay, so then I went with the not fit, non-intimidating middle-aged woman. And these were full-timers here on staff. Okay, well, that wasn't a match either, because that didn't portray health and fitness and excitement and everything. So it was like, okay, well, maybe I don't need a female. And here's all we did was a little differently. One was apparel. We immediately made all the apparel in the store, well over 70% of it's women's that's in stock. And so if you watch our social media and you watch what we portray, man, I feature the overweight middle-aged guy and his hybrid just as much as I feature the super fit dude that just dropped 15 grand on the custom bike. And yeah. I treat them both the same, and I empower them both the same. And so truly I don't know if this is a great example, but like, I think just my history shows that I've got the ability to adapt. Typically the first couple questions are, what's your name and how do you hear about us?
Yeah.
And if anything, you tell us your name. My name's Stu. And I say, how do you hear it about us? And you either tell us or you say why. And then I hit you back with a reflex like, so I know who to thank. And you are totally at ease. It's rather than like, what can I help you find today? Fuck, I know you're here to find something bike related. What's your name? Shit, we're going to spend some time together. We're not in a super mall. Like, you're going to kick it for a minute. We're a destination. So what's your name?
I find that there are people that come in that they're just looking, and they're like, it's like bike porn hanging on the walls. They're like, wow, is that the Merc frame from 1979? And it's just so much fun. Again, we're in a destination as well. We're in this historic district, and we see people that are just traveling and coming through. But man, if mama's next door in the boutique, papa or mama has to come in and kick the tires at the bike shop. You know, it's just like, it's just a common ground.
Totally. And it's one like, it's, you know, there's a couple of things. One, like our business has grown so much online, and we're shipping all over the country at this point. But it's funny, you know, I always go back to this rule that the first guy I worked with in real estate used to say, and I'd get so busy on all these other efforts, and then the phone would ring and somebody would want to see a property. And he'd go, hey, you too busy to sell a home? And it's one of those, so we have a policy here, whoever enters the door is the most important person in the room. So somebody comes in the door, you better believe this laptop gets folded shut and I'm looking them dead in the eye. That's the most important person. There's no, for instance, you can't have a smartwatch. I don't allow any of the employees to have smartwatches, because if you're looking down and you're hitting ignore or what, fuck, man, it's a distraction. And it's the same way if I'm talking to a salesman and I catch them looking down, I always fire out like a, hey, man, if you need to grab that and regroup with me later on, that's cool. Like, dude, I came to you and I came to spend money and I came to find something out in your space. Take care of me. So it's funny, truly, like the breakdown answer for how do we approach those folks is you get, just give a damn. And it sounds so simple, but really it is like, And I have found that if you are super fit and wearing, you know, really rad tailored clothing and you look like fit, you look like the profile athlete, and you stop and look them dead in the eye and say, "What's your name?" Like the most a lot
disarms.
Of stuff comes off, right? Yeah. Like a lot of things chill. And, you know, here we have the policy. We ask if you want a water or beer. And we don't, you know, and I always love firing back and, "Hey, fear none. Like, we don't sell it because we're not legally able to sell it. We can only give it away."
God dang it. We had the same thing.
Dude, I'm not trying to get you fucked up so I can take advantage of you. I just find that, man, if we're looking at a high-end bike, it's going to be a conversation. We're going to need to do a fit and consult. It's going to take a sec. And if I give you a beer, everything just chills a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah. So it just sets the tone.
I want to pop in here because as I mentioned at the top, I had the pleasure of spending some time at Victory Bicycle Studio. And I even love the fact that you call it a studio because it's much more than a shop. You know, Steve Jobs obviously revolutionized computers. He totally revolutionized phones, and he revolutionized retail. And I dare say that you've kind of revolutionized the bike shop experience. It's a delightful, bright, clean, joyful. It's got a, you know, you've got your mechanic stands back there cleaned up and all the tools. But a lot of these places, you walk into these things, they're grimy. There's some long haired, greasy dude there, you know, and there's none of that. And all of these human connective tissue exercises you're describing, look someone in the eye, ask them their name, engage, make them feel seen, appreciated, de-intimidate them. That is next level. And with that, you mentioned you sold real estate, you mentioned medical technology. I'm hearing a pivot in here somewhere where you decided that I want to be a bike guy when I grow up. And so my question is, what's your swan dive?
Yeah. You know, I would say I really had two swan dives. One was the first trigger pull, which was starting the shop. And that was, when I turned 18, I started a coaching company. And I had to wait till I was 18 because my dad said he didn't want me getting sued, or he didn't want to get sued for liability if I were to hurt somebody. So people kept coming to me. They saw me as the fast guy in town. So they wanted me to help. What was I doing, right? What kind of training was I doing? And would I coach them? And it was one of those, you got to understand, you're going to hear a lot of entrepreneurship and these swan dives that I'm going to tell you about. Because I'm going to do two with you. But one was people kept asking me, and you know, if enough people ask, okay, I need to deliver something. So I turn 18, I get a license to start coaching. I build a coaching business. It grows and grows and grows all through college. I ultimately sell it after college. It was awesome, and I learned a ton. And it was one that all of those people, as I was really getting back into it, I sold the coaching company, non-compete ends. I'm selling medical software. I worked for great people, but it was just not a personality match. It was all behind the phone. It wasn't face to face. I was blowing my brains out, making 40 plus calls a day. I learned a ton about phone etiquette, and I use a lot of those skills today, but God, that job was terrible. But it was one that while I was doing that, I was like, hey, I could start coaching again. People were starting to hit me up. And by now, I had gotten out of selling high-end real estate, where I learned how to really talk to a what I would call a upper echelon or executive level clientele, because I was really cloistered into the higher end real estate. So I learned how to speak to those individuals and speak to that market. And so it's funny, I decided, okay, if I'm going to start coaching again, I'm going to go high end, raise my fees, take way less people, but it's going to be a very high touch. And I did that, and it grew and grew and grew, and it went very, very quickly. It went so quickly to the point I stopped doing the medical software, focused exclusively on the coaching business, grew again and again. And all of a sudden, these athletes are hitting me up for products, right? So here it comes. And that's where all of a sudden, okay, so I'm going with them now to the local bike shop to pick out a bike. And I know all the bike shop owners, and they know me from growing up in town. And I'm going, hey, just waving, hey, give me a second. I'm going to bring you a sale, right? Like, just let me do my jam. I'm going to bring you a sale. And it's, you know, that kept adding up. And I worked with a local fitter in town who also, it's funny, he used to be my boss when I was in high school at another shop. And so if I was going to coach you, you had to get fit by him. So he and I are having beers, catching up, total just buddies. And he goes, man, are these guys hitting you up for like products? I go, yeah, all the time. And he's like, man, I'm putting 5 and 6 and 7 grand on my credit card for these guys and ordering their bikes. And I was like, okay, well, he goes, should we do a shop together, like a little shop, and not go real big? If we just take our current database of customers, it'll be profitable. You know, we may not make a lot of money, but it'll be profitable. And so we decide to do it. Form a partnership. It's a 50-50 partnership. We go into it. It was a great success out the gate. We thought it was going to be 90% service, 10% sales. It completely shifted. It was probably the other way, 90-10.
Damn.
And we started Victory Bicycle Studio, $7,500 each. We started it with $15,000. To this day, not another dollar has ever been put into the business. And now it's a multi-million dollar business. So that is a fact. That I do like to boast, because it wasn't, we didn't have a fucking seed round or take on, you know, all these entrepreneurs nowadays want investors and everything. And I get pitched stuff all the time that I'm like, man, if, hold on. So you mean to tell me like I could get 10 cents of every biscuit sale at this chicken and biscuit joint? Like, you know what I mean? It was ground up. Ready? So that's first swan dive.
But wait a minute. Hold on a second. There were several swan dives, because I feel like it was a continual pivot. I don't think it ever stops once you started. Once you started, you saw several different pieces of opportunity. So there, that to me, that whole story, that swan dive one, as you described it, was fluid as hell. You moved here, there, and then over here. So what's swan dive two, part two?
Swan dive two is partnerships are tough.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one, my business partner and I, the great thing is we have a very amicable relationship. We still own the building here together, which we've owned now for a while, but it was one that it very quickly came. You can tell I have a ton of energy, and we had a pretty big age gap, and he was ready to slow down. I'll never forget when we started the business, we met with a mediator when we're designing this partnership agreement. And he said, what are the goals? And Stu, you'll like this, because this actually comes back full circle to your last trip to Memphis. So we sit down, and he goes, what are your goals? And my business partner at the time says, I want to be able to have a successful enough business we can purchase real estate and pay for that real estate with our business. I was like, cool. Clark, what's your goal? I said, my goal is I need health insurance. So my goal is to build this business big enough. We have enough employees. We can get a group health policy because I need health insurance. Awesome. Those were our goals. And it was one, like, right. We didn't start out with it. We had started out with one employee. That's not enough for a group plan. So we're building and building and building over time. And I'll never forget. So year two, we purchased one of the buildings. We're in two buildings now, but we purchased one of them that we're in now. And my partner and I agreed not to take a salary until we had this building paid for. And we did this owner finance because we were young. We were a year old business. No bank was going to loan us money. We knew the guy that owned this building. He did this owner finance that he was licking his lips on. It was going to mature so strongly in 5 years. You know, we'd end up paying a fortune for this place. We paid it off in 2.5 years. Every single dollar went right into the building to pay it off. And I'll never forget, it was almost the day we paid it off. It was like my partner had reached a finish line. Mm. And he was getting more lax. And that's not my attitude. If you can tell, I have a hard time relaxing. And timing arrived, and it arrived where I was able to purchase him out completely out of the business. And that was one that was the biggest check I've ever written. That was also one that, it was scary. It was totally scary. And I'll never forget at that table, I looked up at him and he had his attorney and I had mine. And I go, man, do you know how I know this is fair? And I'm like trying to say this, I'm sure of, with like a trembling voice. And I go, because if right now you write me this check, I'll walk. And I was dead serious. It wasn't poker. It wasn't manipulation. It was total sincerity and also fright. And it was one that I'll never forget. Leaving that table that day, I was like, now everything's on me. Mm-hmm. Now I get to suffer from my screw-ups, and now I get to yield the great benefits from successes. And it was one that from that day, I mean, it just, and you got to know the day I bought him out, the operating account was dog shit. And I still had a payroll. At this time, I had four full-time employees. It was scary as shit. It was no doubt scary, but finally, I was pumped to pour gasoline on efforts, and I was pumped not to share. I mean, call it selfish. I mean, look, there's a lot of teamwork on the bike, but there's also a lot of selfishness on the bike to being solo, and same thing in business. And finally, I didn't have to share, and I could roll.
Mm. Yeah. Well, if it ain't scary, it's not really a swan dive, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like, and we always say, you know, that first step is tough, but then gravity takes over, man. Yeah. And it's just, you're going somewhere. Obviously you went in a fine direction. One of the things that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And it's really nice when someone has absolute clarity on the lane they want to pick and their strength and their skill set. And you've got some secret sauce that makes yours, you know, very distinctive, a real unicorn in the space. Thanks. One of the things that you're doing, and there'll be a link to this on the website as well, is you're doing something called the Couch to 50. You get these folks from couch potato, watching Netflix and chill, to riding 50 miles. And there's a beautiful quote from a 50-year-old woman named Dee Dee who said, "No matter what you do, every time he gives some information, he being Clark, something sticks that didn't stick before." And you're out there in the mix giving people pointers and cheering them on. I think that's really beautiful on a lot of levels. You're connecting people, you're building community, and of course you're getting people into their bodies and in nature. Tell me about that endeavor and where it's come from and where it's going.
No doubt the Couch to 50 has been the most successful effort Victory's had. And I can tell you, originally it came about as, you know, for years, I leveraged my fitness and my background in racing to drive traffic. And with that, I used to do these high-end catered trips. This was a big shift in business where all of a sudden I shifted from 10 to 12 guys that were spending big money with me every year to do a couple events to the masses. And I again went after, wait a second, everyone in town is now chasing this tail, trying to chase this high-end business. No one's focusing on the entry-level riders. We started as just that. We would literally teach you, for instance, the first day of a Couch to 50 program is we teach you how to get on and off the bike. We teach you how to get your bike in and out of your car. We teach you how to pump your tires. It is the most basic form. We tackle every obstacle you could ever have, right? Because I'm speaking to an individual that couch to, a lot of these folks haven't even fucking ridden a bike in 10, 15 years. A lot of these individuals are getting a bike just for the very first time. So, right, the first thing is, well, wait, so y'all meet 10 miles from here out in the, you know, out on the country roads? How do I get my bike there? Well, let me show you how to get in and out of your car. Again, it was very just authentic because I give a damn. And it's one that you got to know, the Couch to 50 program, it's, I always say it's one of the most successful things because the customer is our marketer. They are going to lose weight. They're going to meet a shitload of people. They're going to make a lot of new friends. Byproduct, work productivity is going to go up. They're going to get a good looking tan. And they're going to feel better. You know, they're going to sleep better, like all the benefits of exercise. But yeah, Couch to 50 started and we threw this out there and it would all start and it would build for a big charity event over in Little Rock. So the big thing here was I wanted to put a carrot out there. It was a 4-month training program that all built for this big ride over in Little Rock. And that is, hey, very few people do the marathon in their hometown. They pick a destination. They go down to Miami, Florida. They go to Disney World. They go to wherever, right? Like destinations. So same thing. I wanted to train people, then take them to this destination, surround them with people that made the same sacrifices every weekend for the last 4 months, and watch that shit grow. Mm. And it's infectious. So fast forward Now I bought the property that's on the backside of this church. It's 8 acres. I've got an event space. We have our own private place where all of our rides meet and nobody can mess with it. We're under wow. total control.
I think it's important to note too, and as folks you'll see in the video, every one of these riders is wearing a beautiful Victory jersey. I suspect they're the lion's share of them are outfitted on your bikes or your gear. And so there's just this organic flow of sales that are made with and received with love, and everybody's winning, you know? So from a business model standpoint, not only are you creating this just warm, fuzzy group of happy humans, but, you're getting paid well.
Dude, it's badass.
It's great. Like, it's a beautiful thing, man. It's capitalism at its best.
The coolest thing about the economics is, and I'm so happy this is recorded and so happy this is going to stay out there. And I hope customers hear this because I love breaking down the economics of it because it is so authentic and it's about to be as transparent as it comes. Ready? So this group has grown so big, it employs 6 coaches. So this group is so, I can't take on 237 people on my own, not possible. And it's, and I'm going to break down to you what makes a coach because they're paid. And I find that if you pay people, it's a lot easier to manage them. So it's one of those, like, I can tell you what a coach provides and why that's so critical to the retention and growth of this because it is the neatest thing. And now we have corporate sponsors and I love telling their corporate sponsors how it employs people and how they're paid and what metrics they have to meet. But give you an idea. When it comes to the sales part of this is number one, it's $199. The price of the group has not changed since its inception. Monthly clinic off the bike, $120 jersey, 4 months of training, and then you get a 20% off nutrition throughout the program. Now, the nutrition throughout the program is, because again, this is very strategic, I need you coming in. And if you're following the training program, you're coming in at least every 2 weeks to buy another bag of hydration mix and to get a handful of gels and bars that you need for the ride coming up. So it's one of those that like, I do that because I need you coming in, yes, to make those purchases, but it gives us face time. And when I got 237 people, we're not going to be able to totally catch up out there. Like not going to happen, man. There's a lot of moving pieces. But if you come in and we can breathe and there's no variables and there's no cars and you're not shifting and we're not braking, you can ask me about your butt's going numb. Your hands hurt. You had a hard time fixing your flat tire the other day. Can you show me some pointers? Now, the economics is you are not allowed to buy any bike in the first 30 days. And you've got to know this. Dudes, if you come to the first couch to 50 or the second couch to 50 or the third, you are so hooked. You are so hooked. You're coming in here wanting a new bike, wanting all the latest gear. You are wanting it. And we will not sell it to you. And we do that for a couple reasons. One, if you come in because you're so hooked and you got to understand, like, I need you on your hybrid. I need you on that old ass beach cruiser. I need you on whatever shit bike you're signing up with because I want to show you how much better it's going to be. And if you come in and you want to buy an entry level road bike, guess what's going to happen in 2 months, now a month out from Big Ride Day? You're wishing you got carbon. So now you're upset with me because you got to buy 2 bikes instead of 1. Now you should have gotten the better shorts, but you got the cheaper shorts. So it's one of those, like, it is truly made. We will not sell you anything in the first 30 days. We only want you hooked. The coolest thing about our sales model is we ride with you every Sunday. Why would we ever sell you the wrong thing? It's authentic in that manner. Like, I'm not going to sell you shitty gloves because I don't want to hear you complaining about your hands. I want to hear you talking about that awesome downhill back there or how much faster you were this lap than last week. I don't want to hear about the wrong product. So I'm only going to sell you the shit I would use.
Yeah. From a sales standpoint, you know, you've got a gut, man. You've got instincts that help somebody, but also how does a human motivation work?
Well, yeah. 237 people that are making a lifestyle change and losing weight and now they're posting about it on the weekends and they're doing selfies and they're talking about it in the break room in the office. And man, that's how this business grows. It's not just their purchasing. It's their ability to refer and tell folks about what we're doing and bring a friend into the program next year. And so, yeah, it's one that like, it is so fun. Like, yeah, I need you to show up. Like, I don't give a damn about the $200. Like, I absolutely don't need it. I need you to show up.
Yeah. Clark, how old are you?
Man, I will be 40 this year.
40. What? Nice. Love it. Love 40. What do you want?
What do I want? Look, I do want to retire at some point. I heard an awesome podcast recently where this guy was talking about he had just sold his business and made a strong sum of money. But he had done some really incredible things throughout the business. And they talked about that and the byproduct of the lives he's changed. And I thought about that actually going into today's talk with you guys. And that is, look, I'm a businessman, 100%, whether it's, acquiring the real estate as the business grows, and all the other facets, it's far more outside of these four brick walls here. But it's one that like, yes, I got into this for business. I got in this to make a living. I got into this. The byproduct has been, man, my team and I have made this city healthier. We've shown this city the beauty involved. I mean, dude, this weekend I got videographers from Outside Magazine coming in this weekend to do a piece here, and I'm going to show them all around this city. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those like it's so I'm looking at all the byproducts of this, but what do I want, man? Look, I want to retire. I want to have the financial ability to be retired. I'd like to be out west somewhere. My wife likes the beach. I like the mountains. So California does make sense. But it's one that like.
So that's your riding your bike? What does that look like?
I'm a serial entrepreneur. I don't think I'd ever be able to totally retire. I really have a lot of interests in some other spaces. And there's a couple things that I'd still like to do in the bike biz. But look, I'd like the ability to financially retire, live out west, and ride my bike really whenever I want. And look, I don't need to go ride for 6 hours, 8 hours. For me, cycling has become more therapy. It started out as a hobby, then it went to a sport, then it went to a career. Now it's a therapy. And I need an hour to hour and a half a day just so I don't choke somebody.
Yeah. And very, very well said. I love that. I love that progression that
I guess I could also say it in a prettier way. Like I need an hour and a half on a bike so that I can give you my best.
Well, you're giving your best, man, to a lot of different people, and that's cool. And that's why that these bike shops is just it's an allegory to connections to people, and just seeing and feeling your energy is what you're putting out in the world, and that's what you're getting out of it. There you go.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, man, this is the time where we say, give a shout out to your business, although this whole thing's been a shout out to Victory. So, but if there's a specific ask or suggestion, we of course will send people to your website. But if there's something special you want to shout out to your people or anybody, go for it. This is your moment.
Yeah, no, look, if anybody's listened this long, thank you. Thank you for your time. Look, a great mentor of mine always says time is our biggest commodity. And that's how he starts. Every time we do a cheers at dinner, every time we do a trip, he always starts with time is our biggest commodity. Thank you for spending your time with me. And it couldn't ring more true. I mean, Stu, you and I met so organically through a mutual friend, your childhood friend, my sweet, kind rabbi that I've grown up with. It's one. So if I'm going to give a shout out, it's got to go to Rabbi Micah for putting us together and having you walk into my store and kick it.
Well, yes. Much love to Rabbi. He got a shout out in our last podcast too.
He should. He should be raking them in.
You got a shout out in every podcast, Micah.
It's not a good podcast unless a rabbi gets a shout out. That's just from me.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Clark Butcher, thank you for being a part of Swan Dive. You are an inspiration. You are a bad, bad man. You do great things and make great, great choices that help a lot of people. And we appreciate that. And it's lovely to watch somebody really, really lean in to their passion to the degree that you have and turn it into your career and a therapy and a meditation and all those things. So good on you, brother. We appreciate
you.
Thank you. We'll see you on the bike.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Swan Dive. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, and share this episode. Also, we are building a new season of Swan Dive. So if you or you know someone who has experienced a swan dive in their life, please hit us up and contact us through our website, www.swandive.us.